and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA, which we are doing on Sunday evening. We're joined for, this is something that we do every year. Usually it's done in November, but we're a little off this year. Our small sample size theater that Andrew Hahn named it years ago, where we look early in the season, we look at small sample sizes and try to see what's most interesting and whether we think they're going to last or not. And the mainstays for this podcast, and then at the end of the year, we do large sample size theater. How about that? We look forward to that. And my mainstays for this event annually are from Seattle, Washington, is Kevin the Machine Pelton. Hello, Kevin. Are you ready for small sample size theater 2021?
It's always one of my favorites, and I look forward to using the term regression to the mean as many times as possible.
Sounds fantastic. I don't know how many times you've typed that over the years or said it. And then joining us from Los Angeles is Kevin Arnovitz. We have to use last names on this podcast. We got two Kevins. Mr. Arnovitz, welcome.
Thanks.
So this we have a great golden opportunity to have an extreme small sample size because the brand new Brooklyn Nets have played one single game against Orlando Magic, and they won. They looked great on offense and okay on defense. James Harden had triple-double. He has those. James Harden had a lot of turnovers. He sometimes has games like that. And Kevin Durant scored 40 points and made a lot of shots. He's done that for more than a decade. I have seen over my years covering the NBA that after a trade, especially after a star player, there's a lot of excitement that happens early on. And especially when it's a super team coming together, there is a undeniable honeymoon phase that exists. Some of the honeymoon phases last for one game. Some of them last for a month. Some of them last for a year. I don't know what this is going to be, but there was definitely good feelings. Harden was smiling and happy. Durant was smiling and happy. What did you take away from that game? And is there anything that you think that is relevant from that first performance?
I mean, I don't mean this to be a cop-out. This is, as you said, the ultimate small-size sample theater. Small sample-size theater. I have the same questions as everybody. Obviously, Harden is now motivated. I do think there's something about, you know, the cultural fit people are concerned about. I think it's a place when you're not the incumbent, other people can say, that bleep won't fly here, right? And so any concern about cultural detriment, like, I'm not really buying it. I'm not saying that he is the model worker or teammate, but I just don't think anything in Houston is necessarily going to translate specifically to Brooklyn. My questions are the usual questions. How conditioned will Harden be in the playoffs? That has been an issue. Defense, is that a real concern? Because I think that's one of the more interesting debates in basketball is, oh, this team is only ranked 14th in defensive efficiency. Can that kind of team really win? And LeBron's teams were notorious for this, right? And then you flip the switch, and it turns out, you know what? When people need to defend, they can defend. Kevin Durant's a really good defender. Creative teams can hide bad defenders, especially, you know, when everything kind of tightens up in the playoffs. So I'm concerned about their defense. On the other hand, I've seen this movie before when I picked the Hawks over the Cavs because in that 2015 conference finals, because the Cavs were only an average defensive team and no team ranked X could ever. And you know what? And I think in the modern NBA, that is only a marginal concern, not a big one.
Well, that 2015 playoffs, the Cavs had the greatest three-point shooting series of NBA history to that point. So, you know, I don't know what would have happened in that playoffs had that not happened, but their offense was as good as it was in the entire LeBron return to Cleveland those 4 years in that series. So in fairness, I'll just point that out. Pelton, you know, one of the things about this game is that, and this is really kind of the modern NBA, in this particular game, the Nets went 16 of 35 on three-pointers, 46%. And granted, you know, part of that is because they had, you know, tremendous offensive firepower, and it's difficult to defend their guys. And, you know, Landry Shamet, who's been struggling, you know, got a couple. Joe Harris, who kind of goes hot and cold, got a couple. Durant was hot. You know, it's very hard for me to judge a team on a night where they're just red hot on three-point shooting. I want to see a night actually when they're cold on 3-point shooting to better judge them. But, you know, this is a team that to me has three shining bright stars and a whole bunch of role players that I don't know whether they can trust. And that's what a lot of this season is going to be as we watch that develop. But how do you see it?
The main thing I was watching on Saturday was just sort of how they were going to share the ball and how they were going to play stylistically. And, you know, that's something that, again, it's a small sample size, but we can look at quantifying. Harden had the ball about twice as often in terms of time and possession on Saturday as Durant, 43% of the time he was on the court, 23% for Durant. Seems like that'll likely continue and that, you know, that we'll see Durant take advantage of a lot of off-ball actions and try to utilize his the threat he presents that way. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what happens when Kyrie is in this mix too, because, you know, already we saw both guys' average time of possession was down. For Durant, it had been 3.8 seconds per touch this season, according to NBA advanced stats. That was 3.0 on Saturday. And Harden's was at 4.8. which is much higher, but you go back to last season in Houston when he was completely dominating the ball, he averaged 6.1 seconds per touch. So it's definitely going to require some willingness for Harden to play a different role, especially when we get Kyrie back in the mix.
Yeah, and it's also going to be a challenge for Steve Nash to figure out how to blend them, not to mention how to, you know, how to defend. And, you know, they've got some work to do. They have three roster spots open. And, you know, they're going to need some help at center, for sure. You know, maybe not every night, but there's going to be certain nights where I think that they're going to need it. And, you know, even in this game, Nikola Vucevic, who, by the way, is having a spectacular year. He is really, really playing well. Anybody out there who's got a fantasy team, if you picked Nick Vucevic on it, you did well because he had a terrific game. And I would expect this to be more the norm. The center is going to do well against the Nets, especially in the short term here. DeAndre Jordan just is not the player he used to be. But you know, they have roster spots and centers who get bought out are going to want to go there. I don't know what sort of trade value that they have left on their roster. I talked to two different teams that the Nets offered Landry Shamet to in the last week, attempting to get a first-round pick. They were trying to keep Jared Allen, as you can imagine. And so to get the fourth first-round pick, they were trying to find a team that would give them anything. And so they shopped Landry Shamet pretty hard, from what I understand. I mean, I talked to two teams that just mentioned it in passing. I didn't do an entire sweep of the league, but my guess is they offered him to numerous teams trying to get that first-round pick. And that just shows you there's, you know, now maybe Landry gets hot here playing alongside all these stars. If that's a guy that they deem movable, maybe that changes. But I just don't see a lot of assets on the roster. And of course, they have no first round picks they can trade. So that'll be interesting to watch. But, you know, certainly they're going to, you know, I was just reading about how high their ratings were for the first game in New York. I suspect that they're going to be a team people are going to want to watch play. And I don't blame them. All right, so I wanted to go over a couple of guys who are shooting it red hot and a couple of guys who are shooting it not so hot. Paul George and the Clippers are playing right now, or at least they're going to be playing shortly. So these numbers that we're going over won't be, you know, exactly 100% accurate to this second. But Paul George is having just a spectacular shooting season. And, you know, which is interesting coming off of the bubble where, you know, famously hit the side of the backboard in the elimination game. He is shooting 52% on 3-pointers, and 8 attempts per game. That is just red hot, awesome, basketball. you know, overall, he's shooting lower on 2-pointers than he is on threes. Obviously, I don't think he's finishing the season shooting 52%. But Kevin Pelton, this is obviously something he's been working on. He's become a higher and volume and better 3-point shooter as his career is going on. It is definitely the role they want him to play with the Clippers. Can Paul George keep up this type of high-end shooting as the season goes along?
Well, as you said, no. I mean, inevitably he's going to regress to the mean from beyond the arc to some extent. But this is a good reminder that this is more who Paul George is than that guy we saw in last year's playoffs when he looked lost a lot of the time and talked about the mental challenges of playing in the bubble. This is actually the eighth stretch in his career where he shot better than 50% from three over a 12-game period. So, you know, it's something he's done before, but not necessarily at this volume. This is the most threes he's made of those times.
Yeah, the stats are interesting because so there's this Second Spectrum has this stat, which is the difference in effective field goal percentage of the player versus the quality of shots, taking into account that player's abilities. Paul George is number two in the league and sort of outperforming his diet of shots. Chris Boucher, by the way, is number one. So, yeah, obviously the guy is going to regress in the means, but he's also the guy who finished third in the MVP voting a couple of years ago. I mean, I think there was some schadenfreude with the Clippers. I think there was a certain joy certain people enjoyed kind of watching that crash and burn. There's some rubbernecking. As you said, there's always this sort of one spectacular failure. And of course, it was the side of the backboard, as you said, Brian. And I think people along the way forgot this is a really good ball player who is healthy, right? And that was the other thing. And it always sounds like one is making excuses, but it's just a fact. I mean, this guy was a top five player before sort of various moves and injuries and turmoil. And I don't think it's going to be a surprise if he finishes again in MVP voting, though he does have to kind of share shots with Kawhi.
Yeah, he's sort of. It was a nice training camp story, and it's a nice training camp story that's developing. As you know, he came back and said, "I've got to have an MVP." I don't remember the exact quote. Don't hold me to the exact quote. "I've got to have an MVP level season. I got to play like an MVP." Or no, I actually think what it was. "I got to get back to my." Here's what he said. "I got to get back to the way I played in my MVP season," where people were like, "Were you an MVP?" You know, but he did. You're right. He did finish third one year, and he's doing it. But I would just advise him. You know, he is a player who throughout his career has been a streaky player. Although his shooting has gotten more steady, but it's still been erratic. And he's also a guy who plays emotionally, and so I would just say, for Paul, somebody who I've tracked, you know, over the years, you know, extensively covered a lot of playoff series with Paul George, you know, being there on site, talking to him at high points, talking to him at low points, he should moderate that and try to avoid the ups and downs. But obviously he's playing great. I you know, the Clippers are, we're going to talk about the Clippers defense in a little while. They're not playing great basketball, in my view. They're still working on a lot of things, but they are getting wins. You know, the Lakers are sort of setting the standard. And one of the reasons they're getting wins is because Paul George is out there hitting shots. He has won them games. And so if a big contribution that he has in this regular season is shooting the ball this way early on, as they try to smooth things out, figure out the new roles on their teams. They've had some guys out of the lineup. Marcus Morris just hasn't really gotten any, you know, traction at all. In tonight's game, they're missing a couple of key players, in fact, and Patrick Beverley is not, with personal reasons. If that's what this hot shooting start does, then, you know, it's worth it. The other guy who I think is just absolutely, but you know, the point that you're making about expected shooting percentage, I think, regress to the mean, right, Pelton? Regress to the mean. The other guy who has just been amazing shooting the ball early on is a most improved player candidate, in my view, and that's Jaylen Brown, who's having just an amazing start to the season for the Boston Celtics, who, by the way, came into today with the best record in the East. Got slapped by the Knicks on their home court today, but one of the reasons is because Jaylen Brown has been so amazing, and his shooting has just been 54% overall, 42% on threes, on six threes a game. So he's letting it go. He's even shooting a career high from the line. He jumped 8 percentage points from the line, averaging 26 points a game. overall, which is six more than he did last year. Now, granted, Kemba Walker has been out. He just came back. Gordon Hayward obviously left. The team has changed. They need more scoring from him. But Arnovitz, his efficiency level has been amazing. This is his fifth NBA season. We do see players take steps forward like this at this point here in their careers. But normally, we see shooting jumps like this a little earlier, especially for players like this. Is Jaylen Brown all of a sudden a real 50-40-80 candidate?
I mean, look, I don't know if the stats are there, but I think in terms of small sample size theater, is this guy making a leap? And yeah, he is. He's a fascinating player because he's generally a guy who's not gotten his offense in the flow of the game. He's gotten his offense in the flow of the game, right? Like, he's not a guy they call his number a lot. He's big, he's strong, he's long, he's athletic. He is the physical embodiment of what you want in a ball player in 2020, and he's smart. And so what I see is the game kind of starting to just slow down for him. He's started understanding the pace. One of the cool things is he's sort of becoming Kawhi-ish in the sense that, hey, I don't always have to blow by a guy to get a bucket. You know, I can use my strength. I can use my physicality. I can make better decisions. And I think that was sort of one of his weak points, is I didn't thought he was a great decision maker. It wasn't that he was a bad passer. It just, you know, whether it was the threes off the dribble or missing a guy, there were instances of that you saw in his earlier years. And I just think right now, watching him go from, hey, he'll get his points wherever he gets his points, and building on that to become this prolific, I'm just a big Jaylen Brown fan. And I just love what he's doing. And he's exactly kind of what they need in the framework of that offense, too.
Yeah, I've talked about maybe there's three or four guys in the whole league I would trade Jaylen Brown for, because he was mentioned loosely, because the Celtics had a conversation or two with the Rockets, and he was mentioned loosely in as a possibility of a trade target for Houston. And I was like, I wouldn't trade him for James Harden. You know, I trade him for Luka Doncic. I trade him for Giannis. Something like that level. I wouldn't trade him for James Harden, Pelton, because we haven't even talked about how important he is defensively. I mean, one of the things about this new Nets three-headed monster, you know, the Celtics are actually, I mean, the standard would be very high. You'd have to play at a very high level, but the Celtics have three players who you could put on those three guys, Tatum, Marcus Smart, and Jaylen Brown, and have a fighting chance. You could switch them and do things. Now, look, even Jason Tatum, as good as he is and as long as he is, I mean, Kevin Durant's going to score on you. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that you're going to put Tatum on him and that's going to do it. But they have a interesting personnel grouping that they can do some stuff, and Jaylen Brown is the linchpin of that. But you look at the way he's playing, he's definitely taken a step forward. Is this small sample size theater, Pelton, or do you think this is something with traction?
Yeah, I think this is going to be the case where I play Debbie Downer on his And similar to the Paul George thing, it's been very important because it's helped them survive this period where they've been out without Kemba Walker to start the season. Obviously, Tatum has missed a couple of games here after reportedly testing positive for COVID-19. And yet Boston, as you said, was still first in the East coming into today. So that's exciting. But, you know, Kevin mentioned earlier the second spectrum shot quality measure, quantified shot quality. That's based on what the average shooter would shoot on the type of attempts you're getting. His has decreased almost 4% this season in terms of the effective field goal percentage you'd expect. And instead of going down because he's taking those more difficult shots and taking a lot more off the dribble with Kemba Walker out, his effective field goal percentage has gone up 4.5%. And a big reason for that is he's shooting 63% on two-point jumpers outside the paint, which is best among players in the league with at least 25 attempts. Malcolm Brogdon is next at 57%. It's the best in the NBA Advanced Stats Database since it started in 1997 and 98.
I don't like this. I don't like this, Arnovitz.
Oh, yeah. You're raining on my parade. I was so triumphant. This is a player I like.
I mean, now the thing here is, just because it's going to regress to the mean doesn't mean he's going to necessarily go back to where he was, but last year he was at 42%. And
oh boy,
the only person who's ever shot better than 57% on two-point jumpers outside the paint on at least 49 shot attempts.
Let's guess. Give us a little hint, like year.
2012-13.
Is it Mr. Kevin Durant?
It is not.
Ooh.
Go ahead. I'm not going to be good at it.
It's a former teammate of his, Steph Curry.
Oh, that makes sense.
Well, that was a leap.
Yes, it was. The other thing, so those represent almost a quarter of his shot attempts this season, up from 11% last season. And then he's also way up in terms of his above the break 3-point shooting. So the ones that are outside the corners, last 2 years, he was at 34% on those. This year he's at 40%. So I do think he has improved as a shooter. His free throw percentage is also up to a career high mark, but again, it's probably not going to be as hot as we've seen so far.
Well, that's why we have you on here, Pelton. But I still say Boston is an intriguing potential matchup for Brooklyn. Kemba Walker comes back today, by the way, and he gave an interesting interview after the game where he was talking about how he had basically been in pain in his knee for a year, and that every time he would do a step back or go to plant on that knee, that it hurt, and which totally puts a new light on how he played in the bubble, because he played in the bubble really well. And he had a couple of step back threes, you know, his classic where he just sticks his foot in the ground and bounces back to create the space. You know, he said he's been hurting for a year, and, you know, that's worrisome on several levels. Obviously he was playing through injury. He didn't have surgery though. So, but it also makes you get all nervous about the future.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavily on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liquor, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and on the Ways to Win podcast, coaches Craig Robinson and John Calipari are here to help. Each week, Craig and Coach Cal use their on-court wisdom to solve your off-court problems. Whether it's trouble at home or a workplace dilemma, the coaches will help you find a winning formula for success. And you'll hear from prominent athletes, business leaders, and celebrities who reveal insights that made them into the leaders they are today. Like President Obama, who breaks down his bracket and talks about how he deals with pressure by projecting confidence, believing in your team, and taking criticism. Listen to Ways to Win wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, let's look at a couple of guys who are going the other direction, whose numbers, star players, whose numbers have precipitously dropped early on this season. The first guy I want to talk about is Trae Young. Now, the Hawks got off to a good start to the season. They were 3-0. Looking good with their new lineup. And they've hit a real rough patch. Gallo got hurt, which Gallo gets hurt. Bogdan Bogdanovic went out with a fractured knee. Still don't know what that is going to be. So they're two of their biggest additions are out. Then Chris Dunn, an indication he could be out much of the regular season, one of their key defensive signings. Rondo's been out too. Am I right, Arnovitz?
Yeah, he's been in and out.
They've been beset by injuries, but also yeah. Trae Young is not playing well. There was also a story in The Athletic about some potential internal team drama, but I'm going to put that aside for now. Trae Young is his 3-point shooting has sort of fallen off a cliff. You know, he had a big bad miss late in the game last night, and then he also ran over Damian Lillard at a game in Portland. So he had a bad finish last night, and you know, I'm not going to worry about that game. They're on the West Coast right now. They're taking some losses, but you know, they're let's see where they are in the standings. They are
fading.
Yeah, they're
games,
down
a couple games below 500.
Yeah, they've you know, like I said, they started out 3-0, and now they're 5-7. So they're, you know, they're 2-7 their last nine. But the number that's I want to talk about, Arnovitz, is 3-point shooting. He's shooting 27% on threes so far this year. It's a 9% drop from last year. And I don't know if this is more worrisome or not, but his volume is way down. He's taking you know, almost four less a game. And I don't know if that's because, you know, he's got more weapons and he wants to distribute the ball a little bit more. But his assists are down. So, you know, this is a guy who lives on a three-point shot. Obviously, he's going to have games where he's hot or cold. Last year, by the way, he shot 36% on threes. So it wasn't, he wasn't at Steph Curry levels. But this is worrisome because his shooting affects the way he plays the rest of the game, and they need him to be great. His scoring also is down. But again, not that much of a surprise. His scoring should be down with the new weapons, but his scoring is down 6 points a game. So, Arnovitz, what do we take from this, and what do we think is going to happen?
When you kind of look at the raw stats, he is one of these guys who's well underperformed the quality of the shot in his particular shots. That said, I think he's figuring things out. And I know that's sort of a cliche in the context of evaluating players, but there was talk early on, like, hey, we're gonna have all these ball handlers, and now he can play off the ball a little bit. And the way Steph does, and that's always been the comp, though I think it's an unfair one. And he is a guy who could spot up and that can take some of the pressure off. The thing is I love the ball in his hands because I think he's also a tremendous passer. But I do think that sort of static, I think it matters. And it's not a coincidence that his worst game came after sort of the report of the static. And there's a lot of pressure this year. I mean,
Lloyd, I like that term static.
That's not
a term I've heard before for soap opera intertime drama. I like that.
There's some keep that. I like that you like it.
Thank you.
And Lloyd Pierce last March said, hey, next year we need to make the playoffs. And I think that there's just an incredible responsibility in him. He is the best passer on the team. He is, allegedly or at least theoretically the best shooter on the team, though Collins historically has been better. And I think they're kind of figuring out how they want to play. I also think from a half court standpoint, building off that pick and roll, now he's got sort of a, he's got a guy who can catch lobs. Where does Collins go? How does he get his shot? There's a lot of things on Trae Young's to-do list. And as a result, I just think there are a lot of hiccups right now. Pelton probably can speak more to, in terms of shot quality and whether or not this is a guy can recede like this. But I think it's a little small sample size theater. I also think he's got to figure a lot of things out very quickly.
Pelton.
I get to be more optimistic on this one because people think of regression to the mean as it's always a negative, but sometimes it means you're performing worse than you used to.
Progression to the mean.
Yep. In Young's case, we've kind of been here before, because if you remember back to his rookie season, he was really struggling to make threes at the start of that when he first came into the league. And there was a lot of chatter at that point about, he's going to be better as a passer than as a shooter in the NBA, despite the Steph comparisons. And then all of a sudden he turned things around. He was shooting 28% or he's shooting 27.5% at the end of December 2019. He shot 35% from three the rest of that season, then the 36% last year, like you mentioned. And I don't know if where his true level is. It's maybe a little bit in between those because he's taking such difficult shots. And I probably would like him to take a few less of the 35 footers off the dribble, because as much as those can stretch a defense,
right,
he's not Damian Lillard on those shots at this point. So. Right. I'm reasonably optimistic on the Hawks in general. Obviously, the issue injuries are a challenge for them, but they've outscored opponents on the season so far. I think they've had a little bit of unfortunate luck to be out of the playoff standings right now.
Well, they've got a lot of time, and he's got a lot of time, and he's one of these guys who could score 48 at any night. He's still somebody you want to keep an eye on, but you got a signature shoe. He's got his team. Finally built. I'm sure he was looking for a really great start to the season, and as Arnovitz mentioned, he can kind of get into his head a little bit. So it can go the other way pretty quickly. But they need better performance from Trae Young. I don't think that's a hot take. Speaking of stars, let's talk a little bit about Giannis. Giannis's numbers are very good overall. He's got terrific numbers. His rebounding's down a little bit. The Bucks, after a bit of an erratic start, have rounded into form. I still think their depth is an issue, and it will be as we watch the season go along. But Drew Holiday is playing well. Middleton's had a few good games. They took over the lead from in the East to the all important mid January standings. But they are now in first in the East after Boston's loss today. But his free throw shooting, guys, his free throw shooting is worrisome. It is plummeted. It is at 58%. He was already shaky, and then he went 1 of 10. 1 of 10 against Dallas over the weekend. They have a big game Monday night against the Nets, so that'll be fun to watch, I hope. Giannis's free throw percentage has gotten dangerously worse over the last 5 years. Back in 2016-17, which was his first year where we already were excited about him as a prospect, but that was the year where he sort of arrived, made his first All-Star team that year. He shot 77% at the line. And, you know, better than league average. 2 years ago, 73% at the line. You know, you'd like it to be a little higher, but still pretty good. Last year, 63%, and now Pelton, 58%. Now, granted, he's only played let's see how many games he played.
I believe 9.
He's only played 9 games. Well, it's more than that, I think. Anyway, he's not played that many games, so you go 1 for 10, it's going to yank it down even more. But he was already at 61%. Coming into that, and then he has a 1 for 10, which is historically bad. It's hard to shoot 10% from the line. It's hard because you have to get there at least 10 times to do it. So Pelton, I mean, this has got to come up, but also, you know, his rest of his shoot, his 3-point shooting is not improving. So now you have if it doesn't get better, it's one of these things where you let him shoot a 3, and if he comes even a foot inside the lane, you tackle him.
So the good news here, yeah, he has actually played 12 games. I forget who I was mixing him up with, but I went back and looked through his 12 game samples over the course of his career in terms of free throw shooting. And one thing I didn't remember is he had even worse stretches than this around last December during the midst of his second MVP season. It probably didn't get noticed because that was about when they were beating the Lakers and, you know, confirming themselves seemingly as a tier one team. So I don't know that it's encouraging that Giannis has been at this.
Oh, no, he's been horrible from the line before. Don't worry, everybody.
Right. This level that he's been hovering around the last 2 seasons where, you know, it's been around 60% after being up in the 70s beforehand. That's definitely not where you want to see him, you know, especially as many free throws as he shoots. And you worry that it does become a mental issue at some point. That was the worst free throw shooting on more than 5 attempts in a game in his career when he went 1 for 10 the other night. But I don't think it indicates necessarily that he's doomed the rest of the season, because he did have stretches last year before the stoppage of play where he was up again in the 70s.
You follow the Bucks closely, Arnovitz. I'm sure no one's really worried, but I'm also sure they're kind of watching with one eye.
Yeah, I mean, I never know what to make of sort of free throw struggles. I mean, LeBron has changed up his routine. I mean, I think our friend Tom Haberstroh has done a great piece once on all the different, the entire taxonomy of LeBron's techniques. And, you know, Blake Griffin's an interesting example, a guy who has really struggled and then all of a sudden became extremely proficient at the line. You never know what it is. He works incessantly, Giannis does. That said, there might be something fundamentally flawed with this technique. I mean, the 3-point shooting question is more interesting to me. When does he take them? Should he take them? Do they mind him taking it? And I think it's very much a time or score thing. You know, what's his rhythm like? How is he playing? Are they putting up a wall against you to the point where that's the only shot you can get off? You know, if they're denying him, you know, at the nail or you know, showing you a crowd, then I think there's an understanding that, look, this is something he needs to work on. He wants to become a proficient 3-point shooter. You know, get above the Mendoza line. Pelton, what's the Mendoza line these days? 35?
Good question.
What's the Mendoza line?
Wait, for free throws?
No, 3-point shooting.
Oh, I see. Yeah. It's league average is around 36.5. So I'd say it's higher than that. I think you probably got to be above 33.
Do you think our listeners know what the Mendoza line is?
The Mendoza line.
Troy, our producer. Let's see if our producer Troy knows what the Mendoza line is.
I think the Mendoza line in baseball is 200.
Okay. I mean, he works for the Entertainment Sports Programming Network. I mean, his standard is going to be a little higher. Okay, fine.
Maybe it's 30.
No.
It'd be pretty bad to hit 200.
I think like it's 33, and that's a nice round number too. That's like an EFG.
I would have just thrown 33. I see 30 because 33 means it's 50% on twos. That's the baseline that you want to see.
Right.
You know, if you're not shooting 33% on threes, you probably shouldn't be taking that many of them. But of course, if you're Giannis, you know, he's taken, last year he took 4.7 threes a game and shot 30.4%. This year in 12 games, he's taking 4.9 threes a game and shooting 30.5%. That is, you know, three years ago, he shot 30.7%. And then he had a year where he shot 26%. But he looks like he's about a 30% three-point shooter. I mean, he's 7 or 8 years into his career now. I mean, obviously they hope that's going to improve, but, you know, that is below the old Mendoza line.
Hey, so I got a question, Pelton. When does a team, at what point would a team employ a hack of Giannis? Given how good he is downhill.
You definitely have to be confident that he's below 60%. But yeah, it is a different, you know, it's a different math for someone like him or like the original namesake Hack a Shaq Shaq, because of the fact that those players are so dominant that partially you're doing it, you know, to try to keep them from being as good as they normally are, as opposed to, you know, someone where you're doing it for purely strategic reasons, like when DeAndre Jordan was hacked as frequently as he was. He was always a case where if you could get close to him, it was because he was about to dunk it and you should foul him.
It's going to get better. I assume it's going to get better. And I appreciate you finding that period in the last year where he was, you know, the Bucks were flying high and he was not shooting as well. But it is a little bit of a nervy number when you see a guy who's that high usage, who's got a five in front of his free throw shooting spots.
Vivid Seats wants you to get to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seat Rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code HOOP. That's code HOOP, H-O-O-P. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, but nothing on your roof. So who's ever up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
One thing that I think, even if you're a casual observer of the NBA, you maybe have noticed so far this season is the blowouts. We've seen a lot of blowouts. And particularly, we've seen a lot of blowouts by teams on their home court. Again, just had another one today. Celtics getting blown out at home by the Knicks, who had a five-game losing streak. Dallas also lost lopsidedly to Chicago at home. Part of that, I do think, is the lack of the home crowd. It's kind of hard to defend your home court, make your run to get back in the game when you don't have the crowd supporting you. Just in general, I think that the lack of crowd, even on the road, I think contributes to teams, with that. But, Pelton, overall, home court advantage has been depressed in this, you know, mostly fanless situation. Small sample size theater. Give us a look at what you think what we should take from that.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, I think home court advantage is probably still settling. It had got, after being below 50% in terms of winning percentage for home teams for a long period of time, on Saturday night they went 5-1, and that got them up to 500 for the season, which went back below that with the two home.
That's just crazy. That's just crazy, by the way. Under home teams being under 500.
And the home blowouts are a big part of that, as you mentioned. There have already been 20 home losses by 20 points or more this season. The most in a single season in NBA history is 2018-19, when there was 84. That's the only time there's been more than 65. So we're already, you know, more than a quarter to the second highest season in NBA history. And most teams have played about 12 games. So you'd be, you know, a little bit more than a seventh through a typical 82 game schedule if we were playing that. So, you know, I do think that it's very possible that we're going to find eventually that when this does settle, that there's some home court advantage for teams, even without fans in the arena. But it's definitely confirming the research that was out there that the driving force in home court advantage is, you know, it's not about travel. It's not about familiarity with the home court or any of those other factors that it's been attributed to. It's primarily about the effect that fans have. And specifically, it seems to largely be about the effect that fans have on refereeing.
I don't know. Can we?
That was Arnovitz's commentary.
So, I mean, this is what I would devil's advocate, and it's a geek one. Can we correlate decibels in arena with home performance above kind of expectation?
Get out your computer and get the decibel numbers.
No, but that's why I'm skeptical of the sheer noise, though I do think home crowds in general, like, obviously are huge.
I mean, it's interesting because there aren't necessarily, like, the teams that have stronger, more rabid home court crowds don't necessarily have stronger home court advantage. The only teams we see that really have consistently strong home court advantage in the NBA are the teams that play at altitude, which definitely is a factor in home court above and beyond that. But, you know, we do also see it go up from the regular season to the playoffs, which is also, I think, consistent with that idea that, you know, the crowds are louder. There's probably relatively more home fans as opposed to in the regular season, especially in the StubHub era, you know, this whoever's sponsoring us era, where there's a lot of road fans there. And we have seen home court advantage on the decline over time, but certainly nothing like we're seeing this year.
Another theory I have is small. Is guys aren't going out on the road. In fact, Pelton, didn't it, again, I'm mentioning Haberstroh for the second time, he did a great piece on sort of, at a certain point, the gap is starting to narrow. And both he and I talked to a bunch of people for that story that suggested that the sort of advent of the app was keeping, we're making people's, making players hunt for extracurricular activity much more efficient. And therefore, nights that would have been 6 hours.
What was the story? The Tinderization of the NBA?
Tinderization of the NBA. One of the great stories ever written about the NBA. And, you know.
You don't have to look for it. You just bring it in, right?
Yeah. It's.
And now you're not even bringing it in. Right?
Not this week. It is amusing that a lot of these home blowouts that we've seen have been home teams playing the matinees. You know, traditionally it was the idea that, oh, you play an afternoon game in New York or in Miami and, you know, the other team's going to have the South Beach flu. But now it's the home teams that have struggled in all these early games. The Clippers, that game where they were trailing by 50 at halftime was one of these, you know, noon or 1 o'clock starts, much like that Boston, New York game today.
Right. Well, I argued that the pandemic killed the South Beach flu. So, I really don't know. You know, this is one of those things that's so new and so unexplainable. I guess I just have to watch it. I cannot believe it will continue, but we are in such an antiseptic scenario. And, you know, let's just be honest, guys. I mean, the COVID infection rate and the contact, we just had another game canceled Sunday today. Oklahoma City, Philly was canceled today. And, you know, the teams were warming up when the cancellation happened, and it had to do with a positive, I don't know if it's a positive, but I think it's a positive test in Memphis from the night before. You know, I don't even know what the status of games is going to be going forward in terms of, like, whether they're going to be played in home arenas or if they're going to be regionalized or whatever. So we may just have to take this year and just throw that number aside. It's early in the fourth quarter right now, you know, in Denver. Nikola Jokic is having another fantastic game. He's on the bench right now, and his team's losing to the Jazz. He's got 27, 11, and 6 through three quarters. Nikola Jokic is absolutely an MVP candidate to this point. He's playing spectacular basketball. More importantly, He is averaging 10.4 assists per game. He is leading the NBA in assists here coming into the day. Obviously has always been a tremendous passer. One of already, I think we can say, one of the greatest passing big men we've ever seen in the game. Has there been a, do you guys know off the top of your head, I should have looked this up before the pod, has there been a center since Wilt Chamberlain to lead the league in assists?
No, I can't. No, imagine. Definitely not.
Yeah. So his, just to put it in context, last year he averaged 7 assists, 2 years ago, 7.3, which was his career high. You know, this is his 13th game. Pelton, can Nikola Jokic lead the NBA in assists? And if he does, is that not a pretty strong pillar in an MVP candidate case?
Well, we've seen historically the value that averaging a triple-double can have in the MVP debate. So it would help him a lot if he could maintain that. And I think there's some chance. I mean, he is benefiting so far from the fact that his teammates are shooting really, really hot off his passes. Historically, if you look at the second spectrum tracking data, his teammates have an effective field goals percentage between 58% and 61% on potential assists from Jokic. So far this season, that's gone up to 67%. So a few more of those passes are turning into assists than were in the past. But his potential assists are also up about 24% on a per possession basis. So, you know, even if that comes back to earth a little bit, I think he can still be, you know, close to double figures.
So he's, you know, he obviously lost the weight, and the losing of the weight could mean he's just fresher in games and he can move a little bit better. So you see, he is averaging a career high 24.2 points a game. He's shooting 57%. His rebounding is up from 10 a game to 11 a game. These are things you can attribute to maybe being more mobile and having better stamina with the weight loss, Arnovitz. But does weight loss help you make better passes?
Because
that's an interesting thought.
I don't know. I just know that when you watch Denver, how much offense materializes from him. And I'm not even talking about, oh, they have him at the high post and he does what sort of passing bigs do. The pass aheads off rebounds, he's great at it. The dribble handoff game with Murray, they get a ton of offense out of that. He's a guy who actually loves passing out of double teams. Like when that second body comes, he will pass. He not only will he pass, he will pass to the person invariably with the highest percentage attempt. And it's just kind of what they do. He is the fulcrum of the offense. You know, they don't have a pure point, though. The many teams don't now. And they count on him to create, you know, and I think that is just sort of the manifestation. I mean, look, I think everybody is, you know, I think players generally, when they're better conditioned, can just do more. I think they're less tired. Errors come from being tired. You know, passes that are 1 inch off a pocket come from being tired often. So I think in terms of just being better conditioned, yeah, it helps. But it just fundamentally, it's just what they do offensively. It is the Jokic show with Murray also just kind of, you know, being the other catalyst. But the so much comes through him.
I don't know if it was on this podcast or if it was just in a private conversation, because I just have so many of them. But I remember being asked before the year if I thought Jokic was a MVP candidate. And I said, well, I think he's a candidate. He was on my ballot last year, but I don't know if he puts up the numbers to do it, because he's not a guy who's averaged more than 20 points, and his numbers are good, but you know, they're good, but they're not like, wow, look at these like Giannis level numbers. As Pelton mentioned, he's averaging a triple double. I don't know if it'll last, but his numbers are there right now. Okay.
I mean, it's odd that the biggest challenge he has right now is his team's record, which, right, you know, they're only at 500. I'm a little surprised, by the way, LeBron isn't getting more MVP talk, because he's right there in terms of the value stats with Jokic, with CJ McCollum, who's off to a great start. And the Lakers are 11-3. It feels like he should be the clear favorite now, shouldn't he?
I mean, you know, LeBron, the MVP, is a whole nother 6 podcasts. We'll save that for later. Yes, LeBron, the Lakers, if the season ended this exact moment, LeBron would have an extraordinarily very compelling case. And not only that, he doesn't even look like he's working that hard. You know, there was this whole thought that like, well, maybe LeBron will ease into the season. I mean, he's playing great, but he doesn't have the throttle wide open. And it's because they've with their more ball handling, they've taken some work off his plate, and he looks like he's doing great, working less hard than he did last year, which is a good thing for him to, good place for him to be. Clippers came into tonight. They're playing the Pacers later on. The game has not started yet. Arnovitz, the Clippers came in tonight at 25th in the league in defense. For all we talk about the Nets and how can they be a championship team where their defense might be, it is the Clippers whose defense has been unacceptable. Now, they are still winning games. They're second in the Western Conference. This is a team that is supposedly good on defense. The swap out from Montrezl Harrell to Serge Ibaka was supposed to be defensive-based. And yet they have not performed well defensively at all. Some of the ends of, you know, they've blown some games late where they just cannot get a stop. At least one or two games where, or maybe they've even hung on. I can't remember. Maybe I saw they hung on to a game, but they've not been able to get stops. This is a team that's built to defend. What gives?
You know, in some ways, it was prophetic of what people told me early in the season. And it is that Ty Lue coaches for the playoffs. And to the extent that they are trying, so they are trying everything. They are doing stuff that when you watch, you're like, what the hell are they doing? And the answer is trial and error. Now, I think they've struggled. I think it's been rotten. There are just nights where I don't get it. But I do see a team that is throwing everything against the wall. They're going to take these next 5 months, figure out what's worked. I mean, hell, they were blitzing the other night. Like they've switched 1 through 5. They switched 1 through 4. They've, you know, they're trying everything. But I do think this is the ultimate small sample size theater. I can't comprehend a team whose major producers are Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, who has, you know, Pat Beverly on the ball often, a pretty versatile defender, not a great but good defender in Marcus Morris. You know, Serge is still, you know, he causes trouble in the middle. I don't think he's nearly the defender he was, you know, sort of 4 or 5 years ago. But I just don't see them finishing 25th. You know, but I do explain it kind of by just watching them. They have not committed themselves to a distinct coverage scheme yet. Their coverage scheme is going to come as they sort of trial and error. It's going to be refined. They will be an interesting team to watch the defensive efficiency month by month, because I do think as they weed out bad ideas, they are going to get much better.
Remember the secret defense, Pelton? Where Ty Lue, like, one year with the Cavs, he was like, you know, we've got a secret defense that we're not going to show until the playoffs. I don't remember what he did do something in the play. I can't remember what it was.
What was the scheme? I can't remember.
You know, all those seasons run together. I think it might have been just straight switching. I don't remember what it was, but I mean, this seems like an easy one, Pelton. It seems like they have to get better.
Yeah, and they're also benefiting, or not benefiting. They're benefiting some great shooting on offense where they're making all their threes led by Paul George. But on the other end, other teams are hitting a lot of two-point jumpers against them, 47% on shots outside the paint that are twos, which is the fourth highest mark in the league. So their shot profile is not terribly different than it was last season, and the opponent effective field goal percentage they're giving up has been much worse, and that's the kind of thing that does tend to even out pretty quickly.
All right, well, this has been Small Sample Size Theater. Thank you to Mr. Pelton and Mr. Arnovitz. Thank you for listening. I can't wait until we get to Large Sample Size Theater and we say, remember we talked about Small Sample Size Theater? I just hope that when we get to Large Sample Size Theater, all of us are vaccinated. How about that for a goal? All right, thank you very much for breaking it all down for us, and we will talk to you in a few days.